Well, tonight we're going to conclude the book of 1 Samuel. But unlike most times when we conclude a book and we begin the next one, we're not going to feel very much of a change. The book of 2 Samuel is just nothing more than a point at which the original large Samuel scroll was divided into two for the sake of convenience. Thus, it's going to feel more like merely turning the page to another chapter than it is going to be transitioning to another book. Now, as we closed last time, David and his men were only just returning from rescuing their kidnapped families from the Amalekites. Now, Amalek had come to Ziklag, the village that King Achish of Philistine Gath had graciously assigned to David. And Amalek attacked the weakest and the most vulnerable when David and his men had left for battle. So let's review that very briefly. The Philistines decided to again try to establish territorial dominance over Israel, especially the northern part of Israel. Thus, the armies of the five Philistine kings that represented the bulk of the Philistine population honored their alliance and their agreement to assemble at Aphek, which is on the northern edge of Philistine-controlled territory, and they were going to gather together to war upon King Saul. Now, since David had established an informal treaty with King Achish, and he was being allowed to live in Achish's kingdom, it was a given that David's private army of 600 men would join in this battle as part of Achish's contingency. But this was an awkward situation, to say the least. David would be fighting alongside the Philistines against his own people, the Israelites. And interestingly, while David expressed no reservations about fighting the army of Israel, four of the Philistine lords sure did. They didn't trust David. They didn't trust his motives, and they reckoned that once this battle started, David and his men would just turn against the Philistines and aid their natural countrymen. Now, whether this treason would be the result of pangs of guilt as the war proceeded, or it was a planned deception all along, they didn't know. But it really didn't matter because the outcome would have been the same. Now, David and his men were dismissed then from this war assembly of the Philistines, and they were sent home to Ziklag, but not before David defended himself, and he reaffirmed his loyalty to King Achish, and he pled to be able to participate in this coming battle. And his pleas were rejected as a political impossibility. Well, after a 3-day journey, David and his men arrive home to find their village abandoned and leveled. Amalek had come. They had taken the women and the children, everything of value, and destroyed the remainder. Now, it is an interesting fact of history that Amalek, in their first dealing with Israel, attacked the rear of the Exodus column that was marching out of Egypt. And this is where the elderly and the sick and the lame, the pregnant women, the young children took their place. And here in this chapter, we find that Amalek waited until the men of the village were gone. And then they came and attacked the women, the children, the sick, the lame, and the elderly. So it is a characteristic of Amalek, and by extension, the spirit of Amalek, to go after the most vulnerable of God's people when they least expect it. Turn your Bibles to Ezekiel chapter 38. Ezekiel chapter 38. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 692. Ezekiel 38, We're going to read the first 11 verses. The word of Adonai came to me, human being. Turn your face toward Gog of the land of Magog, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him and say that Adonai Elohim says, I am against you, Gog, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. I'll turn you around and put hooks in your jaws and bring you out with your army, horses, and horsemen, all completely equipped, a great horde with breastplates and shields, all wielding swords. Parash, Ethiopia, and Put are with them, all with breastplates and helmets. Gomer, with all of its troops, the house of Togarmah in the far reaches of the north, with all of its troops. Many peoples are with you. Prepare yourself. Get ready. You and all your crowd gathered around you, take charge of them. After many days have passed, you will be mustered for service. In later years, you will invade the land which has been brought back from the sword, gathered out of the many peoples, the mountains of Israel. They've been lying in ruins for a long time, but now Israel has been extracted from the peoples, and all of them are living there securely. You'll come up like a storm. You'll be like a cloud covering the land, you and all your troops and many other peoples with you. Adonai Elohim says, when that day comes, thoughts will well up in your mind. You'll devise a sinister scheme. You'll say, I'm going to invade this land of unwalled villages. I'll take by surprise these people who are at peace, living securely, all in places without walls or bars or gates. The spirit of Amalek is alive and well, and its nature is to attack Israel when they think all is well, or when they've been weakened and now they're vulnerable. In the last days, the Lord says he will use this characteristic of Amalek to lure the nations who harbor the spirit of Amalek into their destruction. Well, after David's men caught up to the Amalekite marauders and defeated them, thus freeing their families, recouping their stolen possessions, they backtracked on the road home to Ziklag, and they stopped along the way to pick up the 200 warriors that they had left behind at the Wadi Beshor. And of the 600 total warriors at David's disposal, these 200 said they'd become too exhausted to continue in their pursuit of Amalek. So they were left at the Wadi to rest and recuperate. It was the remaining 400 who found the Amalekites and fought them. I want to pick up our story here. So open up your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 30. We're going to start at verse 21. So if you have a complete Jewish Bible, that'll be on page 332. 1 Samuel chapter 30, we're going to begin at verse 21. David came to where the 200 men were who had been too exhausted to follow him when they had let them stay at Wadi Beshor. They came out to meet David and the people with him, and when David approached them, he greeted them. But some of the men who had gone with David were evil men, scoundrels, and they said, they didn't go with us. We're not going to give them any of the property we've recovered. Each man can take his wife and his children and leave. And David said, no, my brothers, don't do this with the goods Adonai has given to us. He's protected us. He handed the raiding party over to us. Anyhow, no one agrees with you about this. No, the share of someone who stays with the equipment will be the same as the share of someone who goes out and fights. They'll share equally. It's been that way from that day on. He established it was as a ruling for Israel to this very day. And when David came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the leaders of Judah, who were his friends, with a note. Here's a present for you from the spoils of the enemies of Adonai. And he sent such gifts to those in Bethel, to those in Ramoth, to those in Yatir, to those in Aroer, to those in Sifmot, to those in Eshtemoah, to those in Rakal, to those in Yerikmeeli, to those in the cities of the Keni, to those in Hormah, to those in Korasham, to those in Atah, to those in Hebron, and to all the places where David and his men had frequently visited. Well, David had a crisis on his hands. These 400 men who had fought the Amalekites and had rescued their Hebrew families and all those goods, they weren't in a mood to share with those 200 that had stayed behind. It was not that all of the 400 felt that way. In fact, it was apparently just kind of a handful of men that the Bible describes as Ra and Belial, evil and worthless, who had made all that fuss. But as any leader knows, insurrection usually begins with just one vocal dissenter. That's all it takes. Nonetheless, it took all of David's natural, or God-given is probably more accurate, people skills to manage this politically and potentially explosive situation. And while the result is given in just a sentence of Scripture, no doubt some tense hours of careful negotiations and gentle persuasions and soothing a lot of hurt feelings was needed to avoid a very serious split in his army. And we shouldn't think either that all of David's men carried an equal degree of loyalty or faithfulness towards David and towards the community. Sometimes we get so carried away with all the holiness and the loftiness of the Scriptures that we forget that the characters involved in its pages were just everyday human beings. So like any congregation, whether its basis is familial, political, or even a church or a synagogue, there is no monolithic settlement among all of a congregation, and there was none among all of David's men. The matter of assembling for war alongside the Philistines at Aphek had no doubt raised serious red flags among David's men, and it brought many of his army to the brink of parting company with the group, perhaps even removing themselves from under David's leadership. And when they returned home to a devastated Ziklag where they lived, many of the doubters were openly suggesting that David ought to be executed. And now, when fully one-third of David's men refused to go any further in their pursuit of Amalek, regardless of their stated reason, there was a very visible line of division that was drawn now. And in diffusing the tension and pronouncing an undeniably God-centered and God-provided judgment in the matter, David proved his fitness to lead God's people and as their earthly king. The wisdom of it, the firmness of the conviction, the sense of community that it reestablished continued in the next move that David made, which was to share the loot taken from the Amalekites, not only with the 200 who'd stayed behind, but also among many families within the tribe of Judah who had no idea that this action had even occurred. Well, his village gone, the Philistine kings having refused his services, David knew that he was going to have to mend some fences to reestablish loyalty with his Judahite brethren. Thus, in verse 26, we see that upon arriving home at his burnt-out headquarters in Ziklag, rather than keep all that had been captured from the Amalekites for himself and his immediate people, he sent gifts, we're told, to the elders of Judah. The words "to his neighbors" are used to modify the phrase "elders of Judah." Sometimes we can get a little bit off track in understanding what the Bible means by neighbor. In the Hebrew Bible, there are generally two different Hebrew words used that will both at times become transliterated into the English word neighbor. But they have two distinctly different senses to them. The first word is shachen, and it means neighbor in the sense of someone who resides nearby, maybe next door. The second is re'ah, and it means a neighbor not in the sense of proximity, but rather in the sense of relationship. Re'ah is referring to a friend or a companion, perhaps a mate or a fellow countryman or somebody who's sharing some sort of recognized common bond with you. Shaken is impersonal, and it can refer to someone you don't even know. Re'ah is personal. It refers to someone you know and care about. The word used in our passage referring to the elders of Judah is re'ah. So David is using much wisdom and substantial political acumen in showing undeserved generosity to some fellow tribal members, but not all. And here we have a listing of whom it is that he honored. Now, like our president inviting an exclusive group to a banquet at the White House, there's always underlying meaning and purpose in every selection. There is at least as big a message to those who are excluded as to those who are invited. This listing of verses 26 through 31 were leaders who first and foremost were those he felt would support him and would welcome him back into Judah. They were also those whose leadership and influence would be vital in his ascension to the throne of Judah. Now, no doubt the many villages mentioned had been harmed by the Amalekites or the Philistines or both. So the justification for awarding reparations to these Judean villages could be made, as David would have had to explain to his 600 men, just why he was going to give away all this plunder that they had just risked their lives for. After all, weren't they now in dire need as well? Their homes, their businesses had been destroyed. They were essentially living now among ruins. Now, while we can and we probably should credit David with a wonderful display of generosity and mercy, chesed, we need to temper it with a little bit of reality. It's always been so that political leaders buy the loyalty of others by giving away wealth that came from other people. They love to give away other people's money. Now, the final words of this chapter tell us that some of the loot was also distributed to the less important places in Judah, but they had been of aid to David at some point or another, and so he wanted to recognize him for this. Now, how godly this process of giving the spoils earned by his men to these villages and elders and other places actually was, I really can't say. But it certainly would prove to be politically effective from an earthly perspective. So let's move on now to the last chapter of the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 31. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 333. First Samuel, chapter 31. Now the Philistines pressed their attack on Israel. The men of Israel fled before the Philistines, leaving their dead on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines pursued and overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines killed Jehonatan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, the sons of Shaul. The fighting went hard against Saul. And then the archers overtook and wounded him so that he was in agony. And Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword, run me through with it. Otherwise these uncircumcised men will come and run me through and make sport of me." But his armor bearer refused. He was too frightened. So Saul took his sword and he fell on it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he too fell on his own sword and died with him. Thus Saul, his three sons, his armor bearer, and all of his men died that same day together. And when the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley and those who were on the far side of the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned the cities and they fled. And then the Philistines came and lived in them. The following day, when the Philistines came to strip the dead, they found Saul and his three sons lying dead on Mount Gilboa. They cut off his head. They stripped off his armor. They sent these all over the territory of the Philistines to carry the news to the temples of their idols and to the people. Then they put his armor in the temple for the Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Beit Shan. And when the people living in Jabesh Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all their warriors set out traveling all night, and they took the body of Saul and the body of his sons off the wall of Beit Shan, returned to Jabesh, and burned them there. Then they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree in Jabesh, and they fasted for 7 days. Well, here's the story of the inevitable end of King Saul, who died as violently as he lived. There's no sense of gloating. There's no condemnation of this tragic king. Rather, what we read is almost sentimental, maybe even reverent, the word. The account of the battle scene is typically brief, and yet one can almost close their eyes and picture it all as it unfolded. The main confrontation was fought in the Jezreel Valley, a vast plain where countless battles had been fought over the centuries, and many more would follow. This is the same place that our Messiah is going to lead us into holy war as our warrior king against the world's allied forces of evil. This is the place of Armageddon. Now let me point out that we find the same account, nearly word for word, in the book of 1 Chronicles, chapter 10, with only the most minor variation that is really just kind of added information. Well, these battles like this lasted for hours, sometimes days. Almost always they began at dawn. Now, darkness was a disadvantage to both sides. You can't fight an enemy if you can't see them. All day long, the opposing forces of Saul and the Philistines waged a desperate struggle for survival. But in time, the Philistines gained the upper hand. The Hebrews had a retreat, and they did so by fleeing the plain, scampering up this slope to the area of their battle camp, the hills of Gilboa. And as the sun was getting low in the sky, the now energized Philistine warriors cornered the remaining Israelites, and man, the slaughter was on. Only darkness stilled the clanking of sword against shield, but not the cries of anguish as the wounded on both sides lay dying. Who was mortally wounded? Who had survived? What was the final toll? Who won? Only at the rising of the morning sun was that answer going to become apparent. And as the darkness gave way to light, the slain covered both sides of Mount Gilboa. And as the narrative informs us, King Saul and his three sons, Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, well, they were unable to escape, and they became, of course, the most valuable targets for the Philistines. The Bible spends no time to give us a blow-by-blow account of any kind of gory details about their deaths. Rather, we're just told that the archers had zeroed in now on King Saul. At least one arrow had found its mark, and Saul was mortally wounded. He was in great pain. And some ancient biblical manuscripts include that he was shot in the belly, in the area of the intestines. Now, knowing that his life was over, his main concern now was to alleviate his own pain and also to not fall into the hands of the enemy, so he would likely be tortured. Our complete Jewish Bible says in verse 4 that Saul tells his personal armor bearer to end it now for him so that this uncircumcised enemy doesn't run him through. Actually, the original Hebrew says that Saul wanted the armor bearer to kill him so that the enemy doesn't have their way with me. The idea is that Saul's worried the Philistine soldiers might get to him before their kings do. If that happened, the soldiers might humiliate King Saul and disfigure him. That's something that's not supposed to happen to King. And Saul's armor bearer rightly refused. The passage says he was just too frightened. What was the armor bearer too frightened of? Was he concerned that he might get punished or executed for killing his king, even at his own request? Not at all. The armor bearer was in a bad position. No armor bearer would allow himself to live if the king was honored with serving, that he was honored with serving and protecting, had died. If the king dies in battle without fail, so does his armor bearer. That's the deal. No, this armor bearer feared God. Just as David maintained he had no right to harm God's anointed king, Saul, so did most Israelites feel that same way. And the king's armor bearer, chief among them all. The armor bearer feared God's judgment upon him in a way that would affect him after his death. So he wasn't about to kill the king, even if it was an act of mercy. The evidence of this is in verse 5, when after the armor bearer refused to kill the king, Saul committed suicide. What did the armor bearer do? Same thing. Killed himself. It's interesting to me that Saul even called upon the armor bearer to kill him. I mean, it's obvious from the narrative that Saul was not helpless. I mean, he was certainly able to bring about his own death. It was not unusual in battle, even in the modern times, for a hopelessly wounded soldier to ask a comrade to end his suffering. But almost to a fault, it only occurred when that wounded soldier had no ability or means to end his own life. Stop the pain. Verse 6 explains that there on Mount Gilboa, the reign of Israel's first king came to a gruesome end. There Saul, three of his sons, his armor bearer, and so says the complete Jewish Bible, all of his men died that day. This would give us the impression that all or almost all of Saul's soldiers had died that day, but 1 Chronicles adds some information to clarify that. 1 Chronicles 10:6 says, thus Saul, his three sons, and all his household died together. Hey, there's a difference there. I hope you see it. In 1 Samuel 31, it says all his men. In 1 Chronicles 10, it says all of his household. So now we understand that the phrase all his men is meant as a saying, a figure of speech, with the idea being that his men are those men closest to him by blood and by status. The English word household is bait in Hebrew, and it literally means house in the sense of those living together or joined together. It can mean relatives, but it can also include, as it does here, the king's court. So it was Saul's family and all those of his royal court who were at the battle scene, who are being referred to as having died together that day. Many Israelite warriors fled the area and escaped. And it's interesting that we do not find Abner's name mentioned. Abner was Saul's highest military commander, and one would certainly expect to see him standing shoulder to shoulder with his king. No explanations offered. For some reason, Abner was not there. And apparently it was understood that his absence was for some legitimate reason. The other name we might find to expect among the dead is Ish-bosheth. This is Saul's fourth son. He apparently escaped with Abner, or maybe he just wasn't ever present there for whatever reason. We're going to encounter both of these men in later chapters. Well, the news of Israel's devastating defeat and their king's death raced across central and northern Israel, even to the other side of the Jordan River, where a large population of the Israelites lived. It would have taken no more than a few hours. People panicked. To the north of Jezreel, up to the Galilee Mountains, even across to the Transjordan, and areas near the Jordan River, large populations deserted their cities, their villages. They fled the countryside to hide. And even their walled fortress cities were abandoned and left to the Philistines to take without a fight. Essentially, we find that an entire new political landscape now faced Israel. Much of the land of the northern tribal coalition of the Israelites was lost to the Philistines. Those Hebrew tribes who had always sided with Saul and supported his rule were now firmly under Philistine control. But the southern tribes of Simeon and Judah, they remained largely unaffected because of this mountain range that acted as a formidable separation and a barrier of sorts between northern and southern Israel. In general, the Israelite territory of the Transjordan was also unaffected, except perhaps for a few isolated cities or towns. Well, as was customary, after battle, the plunderers got busy searching and stripping the enemy dead. Now, much to their surprise and delight, there lay the king of Israel and his three sons. This victory was far more complete than the Philistines had any right to hope for. To take everything of value from a corpse, from weapons to armor to jewelry, this was not considered at all wrong. It wasn't a mistreatment of the dead. It was the customary reward of the spoils of war to the victor. And to this day, in all armies, the practice is permitted to some level or another. But to add the final insult to Israel's defeat, the Philistines hacked off the heads of Saul and his sons. This was typically not done to a king. The heads and the armor of Saul and his sons were dispatched, we're told, all over Philistia, where they were displayed in their temples, trophies set before their deities. After all war was essentially a battle between the various national gods. So in the eyes of the Philistines, their Philistine gods had defeated the one Israelite god, Jehovah. And ironically, the Philistines had no way of knowing the truth that the God of Israel had long ago abandoned King Saul. Now he was with David, the Nagid, the king in waiting. Saul had been on his own in this battle. Basically, the Lord merely used the Philistines to remove the anti-king and pave the way for God's anointed king. Yet David, the one that God was now present with, was living freely in Philistine territory, even being protected and subsidized by the Philistine king, Achish. What an irony. Now, verse 10 tells us that while Saul's skull and his armor were presented to the goddess of fertility, Astarte, this is where we get the name Easter from, his body was taken to the city of Beit Shan, and he was affixed to the city wall. Beit Shan is a well-known, long-established fortress of the Canaanites. It had been built centuries earlier. It had been fought over countless times because it was in a very strategic location. Even the Egyptians occupied it for about a 200-year period beginning at a time not long before the Exodus. It was located at a junction of a very important east-west trade highway that connected the Jezreel Valley with Gilead and the main road that connected the north to the south of Canaan. Caravans and armies used these routes since time immemorial, and the importance of these highways never ceased being of the greatest value to merchants and conquerors and kings. Well, apparently, the Philistines controlled the Beit Shan fortress at this time, and they wanted to send a powerful message to all who passed by that Israel's time was over and that the era of Philistine hegemony in the region had begun. So they hung the headless bodies of Saul and his sons onto those city walls, and they allowed nature's scavengers to start to work on them. This could only have indicated the immense hatred, the disrespect that the Philistines had for Saul and his northern tribal coalition. But the men of the Transjordanian city of Jabesh Gilead heard about this atrocity. They couldn't bear the thought, so they determined they would not let such an insult stand. Were these warriors of Jabesh Gilead so brave and pious that they would risk their own lives, that no son of Israel would sway in the evening breeze for the amusement of their enemy? In a way, yes, but there was more to it than that. Recall that there had been a strong connection between the tribe of Benjamin and the city-state of Jabesh Gilead for many years prior to Saul's death. It all began with the matter when Israel went to war with the tribe of Benjamin over the incident of the residents of that Benjamite city of Gibeah, which, by the way, was Saul's hometown, raping a traveler's concubine to death. And that act was so horrific that all the Israelite tribes got together and demanded that those responsible in Gibeah be brought to justice. But the tribe of Benjamin said they weren't going to allow it. So the other 11 tribes of Israel went to war with Benjamin and nearly brought them to extinction. Not long after that, Israel attacked the Transjordanian city of Jabesh Gilead with the intent of exterminating every man, woman, and child. But the Israelites found 400 virgins of marrying age in the city and decided to spare them. Instead, they gave them to the few surviving Benjamite males for wives as a means of regenerating their tribe. Thus, the residents of Jabesh Gilead and the tribe of Benjamin, including Saul's clan, were bound now by blood. And the existence of both Benjamin and Jabesh Gilead was only because of their intermarriage. Later, when Jabesh Gilead came under attack by the Ammonite king Nahash, Saul from Gibeah marched all night with a contingent of Benjamite soldiers to rescue them. So from this, we can understand now the extremely close ties, the deep affection that the residents of Jabesh Gilead had for Saul and for his family. The brave men of Jabesh Gilead marched through the night to right this horrible wrong. Saul's reign had not wrung all truth and gratitude and courage out of Israel. They crossed over the Jordan at night. They waited until the residents of Beit Shan were asleep behind the safety of their walls, and then they stealthily hoisted Saul and his sons' headless bodies down. They carried the corpses all the way back to Jabesh Gilead for what must have been to them a proper and honorable burial. But we cannot overlook a bit of a mystery. As the narrative explains, that the men of Jabesh burned the bodies and then took the remaining bones and buried them. This is totally uncustomary for Hebrew burial. The Torah forbids the burning of Hebrew bodies except for the most heinous crimes. Leviticus 20:14, if a man marries a woman and her mother, it is depravity. They are to be put to death by fire, both he and they, so there will not be depravity among you. Leviticus 21:9, the daughter of a Kohen, a priest, who profanes herself by prostitution, profanes her father. She is to be put to death by fire. Some have speculated that due to the work of the scavenger birds and the natural decay that had already set in, that the men of Jabesh-Gilead decided it was better not to bury them in that condition. That is an unwarranted stretch. This sort of issue with corpses discovered in all manner of disfigurement and stages of decomposition may not have been usual, but it wouldn't have been rare. Considering the pagan influences that had crept into the various Israelite tribes and clans, and that those Israelites who lived over in the Transjordan especially seemed to readily adopt pagan ways, then very likely this was little more than a rather standard practice for Jabesh-Gilead. Notice that they did not so completely burn those bodies with such heat as to destroy the bones. Rather, they would have placed them in an ossuary, a bone box, and buried them under the terebinth or the tamarisk tree in Jabesh-Gilead. Because they were honoring the death of their king, we're told that the residents of Jabesh-Gilead fasted for 7 days. But this was not to be the final resting place for Saul and his three of his sons. We read in 2 Samuel 21, when we get to it, that at a later date, David would have the ossuary dug up and their bones would be moved to the territory of Benjamin and deposited in the tomb of Kish, who was Saul's father. So as we exit now the book of 1 Samuel, Israel is a rudderless ship. They're adrift now in a sea of turmoil. The Philistines are in control. Israel's in need of a deliverer. The first king of Israel is dead. They have no king. The reader now is left with a sense of incompleteness and uncertainty amid a vacuum now of authority. And even though we know from the narrator that God has everything under control, and David is in the process of assuming the throne of Israel, we also know that the people of Israel have no idea of any of this. But as of this point in this narrative, even the reader of the Samuel scroll has many questions left unanswered. How and when will the Lord finally install David as king? Especially since the Philistines have this firm grip on the largest segment of the Hebrew population and Hebrew land. The same sorts of issues would be raised for the coming Messiah. The reader will learn that a deliverer for David's line is coming. But how? When? Next week will begin 2 Samuel, the era of King David.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.